from the Sky News Centre at 5. Brexit discussions can move on to trade. The UK and the EU have reached agreement on the first phase of negotiations following all-night talks in Brussels. Laura Safe reports.
European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has praised both sides.
Sufficient progress has now been made on the strict terms of the divorce.
The figure will be up to £39 billion. Agreement's been secured too on citizens' rights and the Irish border. Theresa May's pleased.
I very much welcome the prospect of moving ahead to the next phase.
EU nationals living in the UK have given their reaction.
I think the Polish community can really breathe a sigh of relief here.
This will be positive for the British economy.
Trade talks are due to start in the new year.
A close friend of the Manchester Arena bomber, who was found guilty of being a member of Islamic State, has been jailed for 10 years. Mohammed Abdullah, from Moss Side, was described as a specialist sniper. 14 United Nations peacekeepers have been killed and more than 40 wounded in an attack in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The UN mission in the Central African nation is the largest in the world. The government spending watchdog has raised concerns some university students may have been missold their courses. The National Audit Office has found many people are taking on debts of up to £50,000 despite being given little careers advice before enrolling. Molly's a student at Leeds University.
When you're at school, you're kind of told if you're smart enough, go to university. And with the whole student loan thing, you're kind of told that it's going to be okay in the long run. Once you get a job, you won't really notice you're paying it back. And obviously now in my final year, it's quite a scary prospect with such a large amount of debt hanging over my head.
Firefighters say they won't charge a YouTube prankster for a call-out because his life was in danger. The 22-year-old used polyfiller to cement his head inside a microwave and filmed it. And Jack Whitehall is to host next year's Brit Awards. The comedian follows in the footsteps of James Corden and Anton Deck. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Bristol's BCFM 93.2, inclusive radio for Bristol.
It's Friday, live at 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. I'm back after a two-week break and to take a special look at Bristol City Council's progress to sort out homelessness and overpriced housing is Labour's councillor for Central Ward and Cabinet Member for Homes and Housing, Paul Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, as tax-avoiding media barons increasingly use their newspaper and broadcasting empires to further their own political agenda, political leaders blacklisting media outlets who don't report favourably on them, and governments are spending taxpayers' money on dodgy websites to spread sophisticated online propaganda. Newspapers too, printing so-called editorials as if they're news stories. To cap it all, tech giants like Google send the search result you're looking for down a page or two further down the results and demonetize some of the world's best investigative journalists, starving them of an income. What chance is there for the truth to get out in all that? In what's been called a crisis in journalism, how can we see the wood for the trees? We're joined tonight by Bristol University Professor Stefan Lewandowski, who's just as concerned as you are. We're beginning to drown in a flood of fake news. He helped explain how best to read between the lines and recognise fake news online or by the corporate media. Plus, Slaughterbots, a new docudrama by professionals working in artificial intelligence, which warns us of swarms of killer drones controlled by computers. They see the technology as inevitable unless it can be banned, and they're lobbying the United Nations to get these killer drone swarms stopped as illegal weapons before they can be used. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 Celsius, cold and dry. This weekend, that's highs around 7 Celsius, colder but sunnier tomorrow, but rain on Sunday, as we just heard before the news there. And next week, Highs around 9 Celsius, possible snow or sleet on Monday, sunshine, showers and some gusty winds for the rest of the week. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of December, highs of 9 Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Central Ward and Cabinet Member for Homes and Housing, Paul Smith, who can't make Fridays due to childcare reasons. So I spoke to him a couple of days ago. I'm joined by Paul Smith. He's the Labour councillor for, I think, the Central Ward, is that
right? That's right, yeah.
And you're also sitting on the Cabinet now in charge of housing.
Yeah, I have been since May 2016.
But there's been some changes in the Cabinet, hasn't there, because of the various people from other parties now being removed. I mean, surely that's a step back. You need other parties in there and on board, surely.
Well, I mean, it's quite interesting. We've had our first meeting of as an all Labour cabinet, and I think there's a great deal of camaraderie among that group. Of the original 9 cabinet members, six have left. That's included 3 Labour and three from other parties. The memberships of the cabinet
changed.
They
haven't left. They've been sacked.
Well, one left because of. One of our people left because of ill health. The other two, Marvin, decided to change. He decided to change 3 people who were from other parties. And as a mayor, that's his job. I think he said very clearly that, you know, he wanted to bring the parties in to try and work collectively for the best interests of Bristol. He got very concerned about some of the behaviour of people in the other parties.
Well, what sort of behaviour doesn't Marvin like?
Well, he was particularly concerned, I think, of confidential papers being leaked to the media as being one of the main issues. And also, I think he felt that some of the attacks on some of the other members of the cabinet by the other parties, as we've gone through the financial problems that the council's got, have been unfair.
But that's criticism, surely. That's normal, isn't it, in politics? Criticism by another party. They're called the opposition, Paul.
Yeah. So we're allowing them to be the opposition, you could say, because we were the only council in the whole of the country, probably ever, with a majority of one party which had other parties in its cabinet. So what was unusual is not what Marvin's done now, but the situation that we had before.
But he did actually campaign, didn't he, on a ticket of including at least one member from the other main parties?
In the election, he was asked, would he have a rainbow cabinet? He said he would. He did. He now feels that that's no longer necessary. But, you know, really, maybe that's an interview you should have with Marvin rather than with me.
Also, we've got with your housing. How's it all going? Because it takes actually quite a long time, Paul. You know, I don't want to be too critical because it takes a long time to actually build a house, right from the word of purchasing the land. Maybe the council owns it already. To getting architects' drawings, to get the money together, that can take a while, and to actually getting bricks and mortar on the ground to be able to hand the keys of a council house to somebody. How's it all going?
Well, I've been in the last couple of months in houses of people who have got new council tenancies from houses that we've built that were started since the administration. We've now got a regular stream of 67.
So that's within 18 months you can build a house and hand over the keys.
Yeah. So we've
whereabouts is that?
The one I've actually been into most recently was in Lawrence Weston.
And how many was it? One.
Well, that I went into.
No, that you've actually managed to build and hand over keys.
This autumn, 56. We're going to be building 60 to 70 a year. Some of them have been through planning, have got planning permission. Some of them are in the planning system. You know, we have to go through the same processes that everybody else does in terms of building. But we've got a programme of council house building of 60, 70 a year. If there is really more money from government to build council housing, then it will be more. So we're building council housing. We're also funding housing associations to build housing and also providing land to housing associations.
Where are you getting that money from?
Well, housing pays for itself. You know, it's quite a good gig, really. If you can do it, you don't find very many poor housing developers. So we, as a council, can be a housing developer. We've got the land.
Actually, some of the big developers say they are poor. I mean, the people that developed the General Hospital, for example, said, "Oh gosh, we haven't got enough money. I'm sorry, we can't build any affordable housing in here."
Well, we've got a,
and they made a case for it, didn't they? And they won.
They did, and we've got developers, you know, to be honest, most private developers don't want affordable housing in their projects.
Not enough profits, is that simple as that?
It affects their profits, it reduces their profit level, and obviously their companies, their businesses, they're there to maximise profit. And that's why we took our housing land off of the market, to stop selling it to developers, but to develop it either ourselves or in partnership with housing associations. It's why we're setting up a housing company, so that we can use borrowing that we can access as a council to ensure that we're building more housing.
Now, hang on, you've had 18 months. How come you haven't set this company up already?
Well, you won't believe the sort of bureaucracy that you have to go through in the council. You have to have a business plan. You have to go through all the legals around which structure you're going to set up. You have to then do due diligence, risk analysis, all those sorts of things, which take far longer than I would like. I mean, I would have liked to have had it up and running by now, but we have in the meantime been building through the council's housing department.
So is the is this company up and running now yet?
No, it's going to cabinet in the new year to set it up. It should be up and running by April. But as I say, what we've done in the meantime has been building through the council's housing department. You know, we have got 27,000 properties. Unfortunately, 200 of those we're losing each year through right to buy. So building 60 or 70 a year is still a reduction. So the housing company, which
you're going to be able to cross that barrier. Do you think you can build more than the right to buy is taking off of you? Like, yeah, it's over 200 a year.
Yeah, I think we have to. And
when are you going to do that then?
I don't think we'll reach that level till 2020, just because of how long it takes to gear up. How long it takes to get things through the planning system and to get them built and to get the contracts let and everything else.
But so by the time it comes to re-elect you, Paul, you'll be just about standing still.
Well, I think by the time you come to re-elect us with I might not be re-elected. I might not even stand. But by the time we get to 2020, we had a target of 800 affordable homes being built in Bristol. We were looking at how that's going. We think we could even beat that target. When we're building 800, we'll be way past the 200 that we're losing. Obviously, not all of them will be built by us. Quite a lot of them will be built by housing associations, which is why we're already releasing land to housing associations. Some of them are being built by community-based housing organizations. We're also releasing land to them.
What is a community-based housing organization?
Well, they're organizations that are owned by the community. So, for example, Ambition Lawrence Western has got a site on Astrid Close, where it's looking to build 40 to 50 homes. The Southmead Development Trust is working on a plan to build about 300 homes near the Ironside Shopping Centre. The Redcliffe Forum are looking to build about 100 homes above the Portwall car park opposite Redcliffe Church, St Mary Redcliffe. So, and then there are other projects that are smaller. We've got a project in Knowle West, or two projects in Knowle West actually. One by the Schumacher Institute, again using council land, which is looking at building housing that's specifically tailored for people with disabilities, over 100 homes that they're looking at. We've got the Knowle West Media Centre fronting a scheme to build housing in the gaps between existing homes. They're looking at building 50 a year. They're going to set up a factory in Philwood Broadway. They're going to employ local people and also involve local people in deciding where the housing goes. So those community-led initiatives are very different. We've just recently had one of the community centres in Bristol come to us, say, can they build some housing on a part of their car park, which can then, the rental from that housing can help fund the community centre. So there's quite a lot of, these organisations are very locally
focused.
Now that
sounds like quite a good idea, because the thing is, I've heard, and I don't know if you can corroborate this, that you guys are not going to be getting any money from central government when it comes to 2020. So that's not a long way down the road. And that means that if that happens, you're going to have to be making sure that every single service the council provides, that it's almost self-funding, apart from possibly elderly care.
Well, it's not quite that bad. What we won't be getting is any rate support grants. And, you know, that disproportionately hits councils in urban areas,
that's the
because
bulk of the
they
money
got that, more before.
But that's the bulk of money coming from Westminster, isn't it?
In terms of money from Westminster, you're right, but we still will get council tax and business rate and, you know, money from car parking, which I know is a controversial issue. So there is money that we're not saying social services has to be self-sufficient. What we're saying is that we will use council tax and business rates to pay for those public services, what we've got left. The housing, as I said before, pays for itself. So if we borrow money to build housing, it pays itself
back.
But
I'm worried about community centres. I can see things like that being sold off by you guys because you can't afford to run them. And in order to keep the council afloat, selling off the family silver.
Well, with community centres, which probably aren't the family silver, to be honest, I'll talk to you about what might be considered the family silver, if you like. But with community centres, a lot of those are being passed over and have been for many years to the ownership of local communities. And, you know, if you look at, for instance, Southmead Development Trust is running a whole old secondary school as a community facility. They're now looking to supplement that income by building housing, most of which will be for rent, which will also provide them with an income, because not only will the rents produce the money to actually repair and manage the properties, renting housing makes a profit. That's why so many people want to be in that business. A lot of communities are saying, actually, rather than that profit going to private landlords, why doesn't it go under the control of the communities? And that's the sort of projects that we're working on.
But the thing is, a lot of people are now finding, in fact, we've seen the figures around the country since 2010, almost three times more evictions taking place. So you're saying that people's income or the money that they're getting from their work is almost a sure thing for any developers like yourself even. The fact of the matter is we've got universal credit on the horizon now, taking over from housing benefit, and also those who are the working poor, so they've got jobs, but they're having to claim a bit as well. Some of them just simply can't afford to pay the rent pool.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've just been at a screening of I, Daniel Blake, and been on a panel with that. And, you know, one of the points that I made is at the moment, social rented housing is 20% of the housing stock in Bristol. 30 years ago, it was a third of the housing stock. And we have to get back to a position where the social housing is a much greater proportion of what we've got, so that it's available not just to the absolute destitute, the most desperate and the most vulnerable, but also to the working poor as well, which is what council housing was originally envisaged for. It wasn't.
Well, back in the day, everyone had a job, didn't they, pretty much? I mean, it was almost full employment in the 1960s and 70s.
I can't remember that far back.
No, but it was. I mean, I remember chatting to a former chair of Knightstone, Stella Clark, and she said she was working in public housing in the 1960s and early 70s, and said, well, we built enough houses for everyone. Everyone had somewhere to live. So she said, I left that job and went into something else.
Mm-hmm. And we need to get back to a situation where about a third of the housing in Bristol is social housing, and that it is
you're
also available.
You're not going to do that though, Paul, are you? Surely. I mean, you've said to yourself that you're not actually able to build as many council homes as the ones that are being sold off through Right
well,
to
that's,
Buy.
That's certainly the position now, but that's we've dedicated £220 million over the next 5 years of council resources to increase those numbers. By 2019-2020, we will see the number of new rented homes being built by us and the housing associations overtaking the number being sold through Right to Buy. And, you know, we are dedicated to reversing that position. And the government is making us some additional money available. We will get as much as that as we can for Bristol to supplement the money that we're already putting in the system. And we know that once you start building that housing, it generates the money to build more. And the only time this country has met its housing need is when local authorities were the biggest developers in the country. And it's also, as I say, why we've taken our land back in-house so that we can get it developed rather than selling it off to developers, which previous administrations were doing, sometimes sitting on it for 10 years, nothing happening. And then when it was brought forward, we're finding that there's no affordable housing on it.
And in the meantime, we've got record levels, apparently, of rough sleepers here in Bristol. In fact, it's probably the capital of rough sleeping outside London.
There are other cities with an immense problem. I've been in Birmingham recently. They've got a much higher figure than we have. We've Brighton's got a higher figure than us.
A lot of begging, too, on the streets.
I mean, just to give you some figures to actually back up and support what you're saying, there is a monthly count in what are called the rough sleeping hotspots. So it's not everybody who's rough sleeping, but it gives you an indication of the changes in numbers. In 2010-11, the average number of rough sleepers identified in those monthly counts was 5. In this year, so far, the average number found in those same hotspots is 69. So that increase is 12-fold. It's an absolutely outrageous increase.
Well, it's off the scale, isn't it? What's the actual real total every night, do you think, in the city?
I think it's over 100. But I also think that actually just counting the number of people rough sleeping is not counting the whole of the problem. We've got people in vans. We've got people in squats. We've got people who are sleeping in places where you'd never find them. I mean, some ex-service people who rough sleep, you know, they've been trained how to hide themselves. So they're never going to be counted in a count. You've got people who might be put up by somebody for a week, but then find themselves back on the streets. So I would say that, you know, any one time there's probably about 200 people in Bristol who are either rough sleeping or close to rough sleeping. There's another 1,000 people who are in supported hostels and night shelters of some kind. And, the challenge for us is to get those numbers back to where they were in 2010, so that you've got a very small number people who are rough sleeping in the city. But it's very difficult because the reason why the numbers have risen dramatically, a lot of people think it's about housing. It's partly about that, but it's much, much more about welfare reform and also general cuts in support services, but
so
particularly
when you say
benefits.
Reform, yeah,
so
what's happened?
The cuts in housing benefits. So you've had the bedroom tax, you've had the benefit cap, you've got universal credit coming through the system. You've had the local housing allowance limit, which means that for some people, they're finding that their housing benefit won't cover their rent, and therefore they end up being evicted by their private landlord. So there's been an assault on the welfare state in this country over the last 7 years. And if you rip apart the safety net, people will fall to the floor. And that's what's happening. So trying to reverse the rough sleeping we've got when we can actually change those levers around the welfare system is incredibly difficult.
Well, look, let's have a look at what you're doing to try and reverse the rough sleeping figures. After surely what's happened over the years is rents have crept up and up and up because of things like...
A bit more than
like,
creeping, really. Well, they've risen dramatically in some years.
Through housing benefit. That's one of the reasons that the fact that the government will pay for people... pay their rents has actually surely contributed to people putting their rents up over the years.
Well, it's not. I mean, the amount that you can claim in housing benefit has been capped now, and it's been capped for three years.
About over years. Since the 1970s when we started to see a big increase. Remember I can just about remember anyway, 3 million unemployed, absolute shock horror. Up until then, through the 1950s and 1960s, that you'd had full employment, and suddenly you've got mass unemployment, and what happens is the government says, oh, it's okay, we'll pay your rent. Surely that's contributed to rents going up.
What's contributed to rents going up is the removal under the 1988 Housing Act of the fair rent regime. And it was a deliberate act by the government to deregulate the private rented sector so that they could raise rents to make private renting a profitable activity. That was done under the Conservatives. It wasn't reversed under the New Labour government. There's not much sign that this government's going to reverse it. But if you allow the free market, landlords will charge as much as they can. Now, you could say that initially was fueled by housing benefit being available, and the government's policy in the 90s was to allow rents to increase, funded partly through housing benefit. That meant that the housing benefit bill rose dramatically. The government then decided to cap housing benefit or the coalition government decided to cap housing benefit. And then what we found is that people who were benefit dependent were no longer attractive to private landlords. They could get twice as much rent from renting out to young professionals. The lack of new housing being built and the unaffordability of housing to buy meant that suddenly people on low incomes were competing either with the growing number of students in the city or the growing number of graduates and young professionals who would pay much higher rents. So in a sense, I guess your analysis is correct, although it's changed dramatically in the last 5 years.
And what about immigration? There's been 300,000 people a year coming into Britain net over the last 6 or 7 years, really since the Maastricht Treaty was signed, and it started going up and up. It's now starting to fall back a bit, but can Britain cope with 1 million extra people every year? And how's that affected the housing market? It must have just been a bonanza for the landlords.
Well, the biggest driver of the increase in the population is that we're all living longer. I mean, it's twice as big an effect as immigration has been. And it's quite convenient for the government to set different types of poor people against each other, the poor against the poorest, and blame the immigrants. But what we've seen is increasingly a concentration of the ownership of housing in fewer and fewer hands. And yes, that has allowed private landlords to profiteer.
But it's simply demand and supply, isn't it? You've got 1 million yes. extra people every 3 years. Mm. It's bound to mean that there's a massive increase in demand. And I can remember looking at, this is probably back in the 1980s.
But the population's grown even faster than that because...
People aren't dying fast enough.
Because, there are more people coming into the population than are, as you say, dying. Now, nobody's suggesting a programme of mass euthanasia. And as I get older, I'm certainly not suggesting that either. So we're having to deal with a changing population, but without, over 30 years, enough housing being built.
It just doesn't seem to me that housing is suited to working as a classic market. Like, it's got to, it seems. I can remember back in the 80s, I think it was, listening to something on Radio 4 when it was a better station back in those days, and they were discussing the whole thing of housing and saying, well, look, you know, this is something where actually to rent a house costs far more than it does to actually build it. And to say, for example, spread that cost over 100, 200 years that a house sits there, you'd probably be paying something like £5 a week, because actually to build a house with the materials and the labour is peanuts.
Which goes back to the point I made earlier on in terms of us building council housing, is that quite quickly it pays for itself, and that's why we need to be doing much more. And the only times we've built enough housing in this country is when there's been mass council housing building programs, and that's what we need to go back to, because it's actually not in the interests of the mass housing development companies to increase the rate at which they build. And very often, you know, when you talk to private companies about new housing, they say, well, you've got to drip it onto the market to sustain the price levels.
So if community groups start, say to you, Paul, look, we want to build 40 houses here, and they can potentially raise the money to do it and run them as not as affordable housing, but as social rented housing at the same rents as you as the council would do, will you give them the land for free?
Well, that's what we're doing at the moment. And also we have set up a vehicle called the Bristol and Bath Regional Capital, which used to be called the Bristol Bond. It's now got, you know, a long, complicated name, to actually start raising money for those community organisations so that they can actually borrow to do the building of the housing. And, you know, that organisation is working very closely with the community-led groups within the city. And yes, any community-led group that comes to us with a proposition, we'll look at incredibly closely in terms of making the land available for them.
What about, let's get down to brass tacks then, about rough sleeping. What's the council doing? Because, I mean, it seems a pity that it only seems at Christmas that this sort of stuff kind of gets looked at. What with crisis, for example, you usually get a piece on Points West about, oh, you know, over Christmas such and such has now got somewhere. I mean, the rest of the year, of course, it doesn't get looked at enough. But what's the council doing at the moment to get down those awful, what you said, potentially 200 a night rough sleepers in the city? Get those numbers down.
So we've been opening up empty buildings. Instead of using commercial guardianship, we're using charitable guardianship through St Mungo's.
Can you just tell us what do you mean by commercial guardianship?
So what it is when a building becomes empty, instead of Sitexing it and covering it with,
that shuttering.
Metal shutters. And covering it with razor wire and everything else, or putting palisade fence on, you convert the property for so that it can be occupied for a period of time until that building's needed again by people. Now, without going into a long detail, we had schemes in Bristol that we inherited that were with commercial guardianship schemes.
That's from George Ferguson, previous mayor.
George Ferguson, and from the Liberal Democrats before him. That they were using commercial companies to do that. We're now working through St Mungo's to do that, and also some private companies are doing it. Also, some of our empty properties that we've got, we've actually passed on a peppercorn to homelessness charities to then provide housing for, say, a 10 or 15 year period, on the basis that they will do the properties up, because they're often properties that we can't afford to repair, in return for using them to help dealing with the homelessness issues that we've got. In terms of the winter provision, and I used to be involved in I used to work in the 90s for an organisation that used to deal with the cold weather shelters, actually just round the corner from where we're doing this recording, Avon Voluntary Housing Forum. Now, through the city office, the 14 churches have come forward that between January and March, they will be opening up spaces in church halls, providing dinners and breakfasts for homeless people on a rota basis between those churches. Last year, it was just done in January. This year, it will be done for 3 months to provide some additional cover. We've also supported Jasper from Help Bristol's Homeless to find a site for him to do more of his container housing. We've also been...
Containers? Hang on, that doesn't sound very warm.
Well, you can insulate anything. And he's also got a bus as well. We're also looking at other sites around the city that are not particularly used well for putting up temporary forms of housing for homeless people. We're also working with... The people who've got more complex needs.
Yeah, there's a lot of damaged people.
There are. And people who, even the hostels won't house. They've been evicted from all the hostels. They've been kicked out of the squats. Nobody will have them because they've got severe mental health problems. They've got erratic behaviour because of those problems. They may be using drug and alcohol. We're setting up a housing first approach, which is something that was pioneered in Canada, which says rather than taking people through the hostel route where you try and sort them out before they get a flat, with these people you get people a flat but you put in a lot high level of support. So you can only do that with a small number of people, but we're looking at some of the longer term rough sleepers, the people who've been most difficult to actually provide services to work with that and give them a sort of 24-hour support service. So there are a wide range of initiatives which are all coordinated. One of the great things is that all these agencies are working together now. Very often, different charities would say, well, our way of doing things are better than your way of doing things. We're not going to work with you. Those agencies are working together so that we can try and get people to the most appropriate type of service that we've got within the city.
So Mungo's are quite key to what you do, aren't they?
They are, yes.
Well, what about criticisms of them where they say, well, when St Mungo's go around and speak to some homeless people and find out they're not British nationals, they then find a few days later, round comes the Home Office and says, right, mate, you're going back where you came from.
And
St Mungo's shouldn't be doing that, should they?
And I don't believe that they are. I mean, we do know that the Immigration Service keep an eye on, you know, encampments and other things, and they and that they do go around to those. So sometimes, coincidentally, they may have turned up, you know, a few days after St Mungo's there. But the Immigration Service works separately to our homelessness. It's not part of our homelessness service. But with every street homeless person, one of the things that St Mungo's do, whether they're from Leeds or Lisbon, they will say, is there somewhere that you can go where you've got support, whether that's family or the other agencies?
Well, you're trying to get them out of town.
Absolutely.
Get them off your
absolutely. We do exactly the same as you know, when people from Bristol rock up at Manchester. Manchester will say, do you want to go home? But it's voluntary. So we don't force people to go home. But very often we'll, you know, most of it is people from other parts of the country. We'll work with those people. We'll try and find out what they're... We won't just send them back.
It does make me laugh because you've all, another arm of the council, you've got Destination Bristol trying to, like a magnet, to drag everybody here.
And with those people who are here, you know, with those homeless people, very
often...
You
only want them if they've got money to spend, is that it?
No, with a lot of those homeless people, we will also look at, you know, can they get into work? A lot of homeless people are skilled. Actually, quite a few of them are working. How we can support them to get into more permanent accommodation. But the sort of voluntary return home, and I stress voluntary, is something that that councils have always done. It's not a new thing, and it's voluntary, and we do pay for people to go. I mean, to be honest, if people really wanted to be in Bristol, we could pay their train fare to go to, say, Newcastle. They could be back here in a few days' time, so it would be a bit of a waste of money if they didn't actually want to go. But we found that for a large number of people, that's been really successful in actually linking them up, back up with support services that they're familiar with, relinking them back in with the communities that they're familiar with. But if people don't want to do that, then we don't force them.
Okay, tell us about the Homes Board, because this is the little think tank that you've got up at the City Hall that's supposed to have its head around this.
Yeah, so the Homes Board was set up 2 months before the election by George Ferguson. I think partly because people saying, why don't you set up a housing company? He didn't want to set up a housing company, don't know why. So we set up this Homes Board. When he set it up, it only had producer interests on it.
I seem to remember that winter 2015, there was quite a lot of criticism of the council, saying that they actually were going out, Nick Hooper, I think it was the director of housing, and they were confiscating people's tents. So when people were so desperate they had to put up a tent, and as soon as they went away from the tent, that someone from the council would come and take it.
I thought we were talking about the Homes Board. But
this is about why it was set up. It was set up around about that time.
The Homes Board had developers on it. It had housing associations on it. It had a private landlord representative on it. It was all what I would call producer interests.
I mean, I was just so shocked by that. I recognise it's not your administration, but before Marvin and the Labour Party got a majority on the council, this was going on, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes. And, you know, most of the agencies would say, don't give people tents, try and get them into the services that we've got in Bristol.
You know what, I'd say that's theft. If someone's so desperate that they're having to sleep in a tent in a corner of a park behind a tree somewhere, and for someone to come along and then take the only shelter they've got, appalling.
But the Homes Board now also includes Acorn, it includes Shelter, it includes a representative of the community-led housing sector. So what we've tried to do is give it a membership which represents the range of agencies in Bristol. That Homes Board then now exists to advise me on proposals and policies to increase the supply of affordable rented housing, to improve the homelessness services in Bristol, before I formally make decisions as a cabinet member.
Okay, so this is before the city council gets run down by central government and you've got virtually no income at all from Westminster. I mean, this does sound like you're up against a deadline, which, okay, so it's 2020, that's still 3 years away, but, you know, it must be a bit difficult at the moment managing to see your way through this.
Well, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, the council is effectively lost between 2010 and 2020 in terms of what we know we're losing, £200 million a year. Now, you can't take £200 million a year out of the council in terms of the government support we got and it not have an impact. And the council has been hollowed out. It's much, much more difficult. But the one thing that we have put additional money into is into providing new housing. We've committed £200 million capital, so it's mainly borrowing, to build new housing. We are building council housing now. We're not waiting until 2020. The sooner we can build those houses, the better.
What about John McDonnell, Shadow Chancellor, Labour, has talked about this thing called People's QE. Now, it just seems to me as if it's a bit pie in the sky, the idea that you could just make money up out of nowhere and spend it on public services, like, for example, giving it to Bristol City Council.
I mean, I think there's a lot of attractions to that idea in the sense that what the government did, it did quantitative easing in the sense that it printed lots of extra money.
And then gave it to the banks.
And sits in the bank's account. So that money has not been put to active use. And so, yes, there's been all this money printed, but we're not seeing any benefit.
Well, the banks will say that they have been lending it out, but only to people who are going to be able to pay it back.
No, the banks aren't. I mean, the banks are lending less than they used to because they're more risk averse. What they've been doing is using it to basically offset the fact that they've got quite a lot of bad loans out there. So they're using it as an insurance scheme rather than what banks were originally set up to do, was to take money off one person who didn't have a use for it and find somebody who had a use for it, yes, to charge interest on it, but to make money work. That isn't really what the banks are doing now. But the other thing is that people, you know, that say is, well, I'm paying more in council tax, so I'm getting less of a service. And the reason that's happening is because the government has massively cut corporation tax, and it's that those cuts in corporation tax money to businesses has effectively come from the cuts to local authorities and other public services.
So you're saying are you saying that council tax, individuals paying the council tax, is in a way subsidising business?
The increases in people are paid, the council tax goes up each year. The amount of services that the council provides each year is reducing. So it isn't so much that the council tax, people are saying, why am I paying more and getting less?
Good question, yeah.
Right? The reason they're getting less is that money that the government used to give to councils has been given to businesses in cuts in corporation tax. And so indirectly, the reason why people are paying more and getting less is so that businesses can have bigger profits. And if you look at the Sunday Times Rich List, which comes out once a year, last year
you won't find the Queen on it.
The headline,
way.
The Queen
she
was in
be.
It.
Oh, the is Queen she? Oh, good,
it.
Right.
Oh, yeah, she is in it.
She should be number one, by the way.
I mean, I don't think you're in it, by the way, Tony.
No, definitely not.
But what
about
it said
Marvin?
Last year,
what about
we
Marvin?
Had a record.
Is Marvin
no, Marvin's
in
not in there either.
Okay, George.
What,
no. Okay.
What that list said last year is we've got a record number of billionaires, and the net value. Of people in Rich List has doubled. So the reason why we've got fewer services but are paying more is because the government has set up a system which allows far more money to sit in the pockets of the wealthiest people in the country.
Finally, Brexit. We've had a $45 billion the government has now said they're going to be paying for the divorce bill. All of a sudden, it looks as if deals can be struck. What do you make of what's happening? It does look like it's a bit of a mess, but then you can understand why people like David Davis and Liam Fox don't necessarily want to put all their cards on the table. They've got a difficult deal to strike here.
Well, the government can find billions of pounds for Brexit. We've got a social care crisis, we've got a housing crisis, we've got a crisis in the NHS. The Brexiteers said, we would save lots of money and that will go into the NHS. In fact, it's the other way around. Money are coming out of public services, and it seems to be that there's no end to how much money we can find to pay for Brexit. The money you've talked about, the divorce bill, is not the only cost. Over half of the civil servants in London are working on Brexit. So there's a huge amount of money being spent every day on people's wages to negotiate something. And what's been agreed so far? Sweet FA. Nothing's been agreed because the DUP don't want to agree anything.
This club was very easy to join. It doesn't look like it's quite so easy to leave.
Well, I think you could say marriages and divorces are a bit like that. But suddenly we can find no end of money to fund this thing, and it's a complete disaster. And I know you. I think we've debated this before. You were a Brexiteer. I was a Remainer. You know, I'm sure we both had very good reasons to be on either side of it. But, you know, people said there's been a vote and a decision's been made. On nothing else in British life do we have votes that aren't checked back, aren't irrevocable. We didn't say, well, in 2015, there was a vote. We voted for a majority Conservative government, and now we never need to have a general election again because a decision's
well,
been
on,
made,
no, you
irrespective
can, you can,
of anything.
We had a referendum back in 1973, and now we've had one in 2017. Mm. Maybe it's going to be another 40, 50 years before we have another one.
Who knows? But my guess is that most people who voted for Brexit did not realise they were voting to give £50 billion to the European Union to leave it. I don't remember that being on any of the leaflets.
Do you think that the Brussels negotiators, Barnier, are being fair, being reasonable?
The thing about Europe is that they're good negotiators because nearly every government in Europe is a coalition, and so they're negotiating with each other all the time. In Britain, we're rubbish at negotiating because we're used to having majority governments all the time. And we... Basically, the Europeans will run rings around it, and all the power is in their hand, really, because we've now said, oh, we're definitely going to leave on this day in March in 2019. And so we've created a deadline for ourselves, which means that they can completely play us. And if I was in their position, would I not be trying to get the best deal I could?
OK, what do you make of Catalonia? Because they've had a referendum there to leave Spain for all sorts of very good reasons. Catalonia. People would say Brussels waited on the side of the Spanish and said, well, forget that decision. Actually, it's okay to send the troops in, send the boys around.
And it's very depressing what's happening in Spain and Catalonia in terms of, you know, you're seeing democratically elected people being imprisoned for trying to assert their view of what their part of a country or their own country wants. You know, we've never done that to the SNP. You know, we allowed a referendum in this country, you know, a full administered referendum, and you know, I think it's you know, I can see, you know, one of the problems of the European Union is a union of nations, that all those nations want to maintain their national integrity, and therefore they're worried that if one is allowed to split, others will as well.
I think this is a reaction.
What's happening in Belgium in terms of the divisions around whether that hangs together.
I would say it's a reaction, Paul, to the centralisation of power. People are just not happy with the way that power is being. It's almost like the United States of Europe.
Mm. What's like the United States of Europe?
Brussels.
It's a US model.
You know, back in the American Civil War, when all the American states were fighting, slavery was one of the things on the agenda, but another one was controlled by Washington. Mm-hmm. We're looking now at a control from Brussels, and some people are saying, well, we've had enough of it.
And I understand, and a lot of people are saying we've had enough of all politicians. They're all liars. They're all rogues. I could use stronger words, but we are on radio, and I think this goes out before the watershed. And so any opportunity we can get to kick any politicians, we will take. And the EU are the most remote politicians probably that there are, and the most remote bureaucracy that there
and
is.
They're appointed, they're not elected. This is part of the trouble with the Commission.
And it's appointed by the national governments. It's not appointed by itself. And it is also checked back to the European Parliament. But I think there are lots of things wrong with the European Union. As I say, my view is I'd rather be in there than not. A lot of those views are not based on economics, but on a cultural view of where I see our country being. And I guess it's also quite interesting.
Would you like to go back to the EEC then? That was a sort of stage before the European Union and the European Parliament.
I never want to go back to anything particularly. I always want to look forwards, you know. So whatever we had in the past was around particular circumstances then. But I would like to see a more democratic, accountable European Union. I'd also like to see much more power vested in regions and in cities and areas like that, that we see much more power exercised at local level. And Britain is the most centralised state in Europe. I mean, the mayors of cities in European countries have got much more power in general than Marvin has got. And, you know, Marvin has actually talked, and I can understand why, about, you know, the power of cities and the declining power of nations. So centralisation can happen at all sorts of levels. It might be that people in South Mead think that Bristol's too centralised.
OK, so finally, why is Marvin out in China? They've got a horrendous human rights record. They've just actually introduced a law saying that you can do 3 months in jail for laughing at the national anthem. Why is he over there courting their favour?
Well, crikey, if we had that law here, I think I might be in jail. But,
well, we actually did laugh at the Chinese national anthem on BCFM politics show a few weeks ago. Mm. We did it kind of deliberately. But you see, this is surely dangerous to be taking money of people like the Chinese. There isn't any real proper democracy there at all.
Well, in terms of the money markets, there's no democracy in banks in any country. And so, in a sense, you know, if we take money from American finances, from British banks, from Chinese banks, from Guatemalan banks, from whichever banks, none of them are democratic. There's no democracy in that system at all. You know, we're talking about international capital, aren't we? It's not under any proper democratic control. So you could use that democracy argument. I don't think Marvin has gone over there to take money from the Chinese state, but maybe I'll be proved wrong. He's looking for investment in the city
for his underground.
He's not just for particularly looking for money for the underground, but also expertise, because the Chinese have got.
Is this going to happen? This underground, is it real?
Well, you know, ask me in 20 years' time as it happened. I hope that we do get mass transit in Bristol. We've needed it for an awful long time. If you look at the money per head spent on Crossrail compared to the money per head spent on transport projects in Bristol or any other
outside
of London.
Almost any major city in Britain has had far more than here, hasn't it?
And you know, if you go... Nottingham is smaller than Bristol, but it's got light rail. Manchester's got a fantastic system. I've lived in Newcastle where they've had a system. Why is it that Bristol's left out? So the underground, whether it happens or not, you know, there's a lot of investment we could do just opening up our existing rail network again in Bristol. But we do need that sort of mass transit if we're going to encourage people out of cars into public transport. I don't think for a lot of people buses do it. I'm not sure Metro bus will do it for a lot. It won't float many people's boat, I think, the Metro bus, because it's a bus. But as soon as you put in something that looks like a train and feels like a train, it's amazing how many people are prepared to leave their car and go onto that system.
They go a bit faster, don't they? Look, I said finally, but another finally. Yeah. Trump this week's announced he wants to move the embassy from Tel Aviv, the American embassy, to Jerusalem. What do you make of that? Jerusalem's supposed to be split, the UN says, between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. West Jerusalem Jewish, East Jerusalem Arab. It's supposed to be being occupied by the forces of Egypt, Jordan. Still, they were all kicked out 50 years ago in the Six-Day War. But, I mean, this is potentially going to upset quite a lot of Arabs.
There's hardly anything that Donald Trump does which doesn't go against all of the evidence in terms of what is the right thing to do. And I think he just keeps trying to outrageous even further with the decisions
he's
making.
So why is he doing it then?
You'd have to ask him. I mean, I think he just likes being controversial. It's an outrageous decision, absolutely outrageous decision. And, you know, the position of Palestinians within the Middle East is absolutely appalling. As far as I'm concerned, you know, this country supports a two-state solution. The Labour Party supports a two-state solution. Everything that's been done is to make it absolutely impossible for there to be a viable Palestinian state. And there isn't one at the moment, and this will make things worse. Absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Paul Smith, thanks very much.
Is that finally? Thank you, Tony.
So that was Paul Smith there. Martin Summers is here with me. Martin, one particular story, I think, from this week, which I haven't heard a lot of coverage locally, is about the results of this investigation of the tram crash in Croydon last year. It's actually the same firm, First Group, that were running that tram that killed several people in Croydon, that are now about to take over our Metro bus here. Metro bus's opening has been delayed because it was supposed to be open pretty much by before Christmas until next spring. But the worrying thing about that is that there was a culture, they've said, that the drivers simply wouldn't report problems that were happening during the tram journeys because they were possibly afraid to lose their jobs. Now, that doesn't really say very much for First Group's ability to manage Metrobus or anything else come to that.
Well, I think First Bus came to prominence during the privatisation of the bus service many years ago, and they became one of the big, you know, oligopoly firms which took it over along with Brian Suter's crew. So, I mean, basically, all of these services used to be run municipally with a public interest goal behind it. And the privatisation of public transport has been largely disastrous.
Well, the drivers' union ASLEF, Finn Brennan from them, said the tram drivers still have a fear of being sacked if they report being tired or sick. He added that management culture at Tram Operations Limited meant that mistakes were not listened to and acted on properly. There was actually a near crash, or the tram nearly came off the rails just very, very shortly before the actual crash that happened. So, I mean, how can we be confident that First Group are actually going to listen to any kind of warning signs on Metrobus or any of their other services around here?
Well, as you know, First Bus's reputation in Bristol is not exactly sky high in any case. I mean, many people complain that they're too expensive and, you know, essentially they've got all of the problems that are created by monopoly providers with a private profit motive. And that's why, in the past, these things were not run on that basis, and we've had a whole generation of running them on that basis, and the idea that this was going to work and there's going to be a competition which would drive down costs and improve services is just basically wrong. It was wrong from the get-go, but it takes years and years and years before people accept what they should have accepted in the first place, that in actual fact a municipal bus service of the kind that they used to have in London and Sheffield and so on was by far the most effective way to do it.
Another fascinating bit of news this week, one of those things you just think you couldn't make this up. Theresa May's entire Social Mobility Commission have quit because she's too busy with Brexit, apparently, to help the poor. That's the chairman, Alan Milburn, said that she, the Prime Minister, was failing to deliver on her promises to help those privileged. I mean, this is pretty shocking, isn't it? Alan Milburn's gone, various other people from this commission. But the whole point, including Cabinet Minister Baroness Shepherd, what they've said, and she's a Conservative, by the way, have said that the government is actually rowing back effectively in the opposite direction, that social mobility is becoming more difficult, not less.
Well, I think the significant resignation there is indeed from the Conservative minister, because that suggests that they don't take seriously what Theresa May says, so it's hard for any of the rest of us to do so.
Is there any way to... What would you do if you had a... Say you were Chancellor Philip Hammond. I mean, what can you do to actually help social mobility? That is to say, give everyone an opportunity for a decent career and to increase their
income. Well, I mean, I would question the whole question of social mobility. It's the idea that people are better off by climbing up the greasy pole of the social ladder. What we really need is a decent society where people at every level are respected and looked after and their interests taken into account. It's not just a question of taking people from poor circumstances and their children, by being given various leg-ups, can end up at the top of the hill. The John Lennon song Working Class Hero, there's room at the top, they're telling you still, but first you must learn how to smile as you kill. What we really need is a society where everybody is respected from the top to the bottom, and that the people at the bottom and the interests of those people are paramount for everybody else in the society.
Also this week, inquiry's conclusions about Manchester attack are damning for MI5. Findings against the UK's domestic intelligence agency are the most serious since the fallout after Lee Rigby's murder in 2013, but nothing really seems to change, does it, at MI5?
Well, we've discussed this on many weeks running on this show. The intelligence services, particularly MI6, are implicated in working with Islamist terrorists, particularly in Libya. And the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group has got a hub, a base in Manchester, which was set up with the help of MI6 in the 1980s to help fight the war in Afghanistan. They're still there.
Okay, that's time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests we heard earlier. That was a pre-recorded interview on Wednesday evening this week. Labour Councillor for Central Ward and Cabinet Member for Homes and Housing, Paul Smith. Join us after the news as we do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.